Hello, today we are going to be doing a CPD on esophageal disease, and this is based on a rather informal chat between three of our clinicians working at Paragon Referrals, and hopefully will allow you to access the CPD at your time, anywhere you want to. So it's designed to be listened to in its audio format for those of you that like to see something at the same time. We've got some very simple slides with some pictures on, but it's definitely not necessary if you don't want to access it online and you just want to have a listen via a podcast. So with me, I've got Adam Bell, one of our excellent medics, and Mickey Tiber is one of our excellent soft tissue surgeons, and we're going to be just talking in a kind of question and answer format about how we approach dogs in particular rather than cats with esophageal disease. So I'm going to be question master at the beginning, and we're going to start with the approach to those cases that might have slightly more chronic signs. So Adam, I'm going to start with you. Hello, how are you?
I'm adequate, thank you.
Adequate, excellent. I think we're all adequate at the moment. So quite commonly, we will have dogs presented to us with a problem of being sick. How do you determine that the dog has esophageal disease rather than gastric or gastrointestinal disease? What tips have you got for us to try and work out what's going on?
Yeah, excellent. So I think this is quite a common scenario when we get to see the cases here, perhaps with esophageal disease, that they've started out with the owner understandably saying that the dog's being sick. They see some material come out of its mouth and they interpret that as being sick. They may even say he's bringing up bile. And often for owners, that just means that something's coming out. Doesn't necessarily mean it's bile. It certainly doesn't necessarily mean they're vomiting. So it's always worth taking a little bit of time to have a chat to the owner. And the two main things I ask them about is what the animal's producing. So if it's food, if there's yellow bile, if there's material that seems to be coming from the stomach, then it may well be vomiting. If it's a large volume of frothy, clear fluid, it's much more likely to be regurgitation, much more likely to be esophageal fluid. And the other thing is how the animal acts when this material comes up. If it changes position and bloop, there it is, then it's most likely regurgitating. Vomiting should involve the animal being aware that they're about to be sick, some nausea signs, maybe some drooling, agitation, and then abdominal effort to bring the material up. So if they don't do that, and particularly if it's happening very easily with minimal effort, then it's more likely to be regurgitation.
Yeah, I think there's really good clues. I think one thing that I've also found difficult is the nausea, because actually I think some dogs that regurg do look really uncomfortable just before it happens, but perhaps it's not quite as long a prodromal period for the dogs.
Yeah, I think usually it's just before, and absolutely they may have esophagitis, may have genuine discomfort associated with it. Pleasant thing to do, I guess.
Cool. And I think I've definitely gone down the wrong track at least once in my career, because I've been misled by an owner saying they're bringing up bile, and you ask them, they're like, oh, it's like this white frothy fluid, and you're like, oh no, you just assume that they know.
Don't jump to assumptions, just double check with them and ask them the questions first, I
think. Brilliant, thank you. So if you have determined that you've got genuine regurgitation, what are your differentials, and how might you use signalment to help you sort of see your way through the gloom when you have loads of different differentials?
Plenty of gloom. I guess with a very young animal, if the regurgitation starts immediately after weaning in a young puppy, it's okay on liquid diet or milk, but it's struggling on solids, then we might be dealing with some sort of vascular ring anomaly, some kind of congenital compression of the esophagus over the heart base. Perhaps that would be something to consider. And sometimes animals are born with congenital abnormalities of the esophagus or diverticulae and oddities like that. And they'd be likely to show up when the animal's pretty young. Could also be foreign material. Puppies do like to chew things, so puppies and juveniles in particular. But I guess foreign bodies actually pretty much at any age are always going to be a possibility. And there may be some history, obviously, of access to foreign material. I think with a brachycephalic, we need to think in terms of, do they have significant respiratory issues, and how is that influencing the pressure changes in the chest and hiatal hernias and various things of that nature. So brachies are unfortunately quite prone to regurgitation as part of their syndrome. There are also various issues like gastroesophageal reflux, which I think is not terribly well understood, but appears to, well, there are some suggestions it may occur in animals as well as in people. Hiatal hernia is another odd congenital abnormalities. Again, I guess we'd be expecting to see these in a relatively young animal. With an adult, then acquired megaesophagus, I think, is probably the first port of call we want to try and rule out, although there could still be a foreign body or something along those lines. And the older the animal, the more likely there is to be something like a tumour or other changes within the abdomen, perhaps, or systemic disease. But I think megaesophagus is probably the most common diagnosis in an adult animal.
Thank you. And there was a little epidemic of megaesophagus in Australia a couple of years ago, which we think that was associated with some environmental or nutritional contaminants. So we do see some of these weird things popping up or coming up every so often, don't we? Great, thank you. So, what imaging? So we've got this dog that's regurgitating, we've got a list of differentials, and we're going to then, you know, use our battery of tests, particularly as a medic, you're going to throw a whole load of things at this patient to try and work out what's going on. I want to particularly think about imaging. And so if you think you've got esophageal dysfunction or disease, what imaging do you use in these cases? What's most useful? What isn't useful? Any tips or tricks that we need to think about here?
Sure. I think certainly the first thing ideally would be radiography. I think that's a really good way to start and obviously accessible to most of us. I would be cautious about anaesthesia. I try and use minimal restraint, minimal sedation if possible. Anaesthesia partly because if the animal is regurgitating and there may be a lot of material in the esophagus, once they're asleep, they have no protection, swallowing reflex or anything along those lines. And one of the risks of regurgitation anyway is that it happens suddenly and without warning and the animal may aspirate. So I'm always concerned if I anaesthetize them. If you're going to anaesthetize, you'd certainly need to be very careful, be cognizant of that, be getting them intubated straight away, be really careful on recovery, etc. So try to do it without. The other reason to avoid anaesthesia is that in the process of anaesthetizing them and intubating them, you may well introduce air into the esophagus anyway, and you may see a small amount of air in the esophagus in a normal animal after intubation. So what I usually try to do is a plain lateral chest x-ray with the animal either minimally sedated or even potentially just restrained if they're really calm and relaxed, and see whether or not there is evidence of anything happening to the esophagus. So in this instance here, the nice x-ray of a fairly obvious megaesophagus above the trachea there with the dorsal and caudal border, ventral border, I'm sorry, the esophagus fairly well demarcated by increased amounts of air. So the dorsal part of the chest looks much darker than it would normally do. And you may see a foreign body if there's one there. You may, if you're lucky, see a hiatal hernia, although that's a dynamic thing. So you might be very lucky to pick that up on a single x-ray. And if there was, for example, a ring anomaly, you might see the stellation in front of the heart and nothing behind it, that sort of thing. So it can certainly give you a lot of useful information in a relatively low-key and simple way.
Yeah, and because we've got skeletal muscle, you can get relaxation, can't you, with any sedative drug. So I think that's the other thing. I think what I've always thought is if you do give a sedation and you don't see a megaesophagus, that's fine. But if you do, you need to repeat it without, so sort of going along your point. So yeah. Avoid anaesthesia. I completely agree with that. So that's great if you've got a megaesophagus because we can see the gas dilation, you get that tracheal stripe thing. What about other techniques if you're considering dysfunction?
So yeah, what we may want to consider is, particularly because we want to keep the animal conscious if possible, we want to see what happens to the food or the liquid it's swallowing during the passage from the mouth down to the stomach. We can consider fluoroscopy, which has the advantage essentially x-ray movie, but we can do that with the animal standing, we do it conscious, we can try different types of food, we can watch the bolus travel down, see whether it does get to the stomach, does it reflux, is there dilation and so on. So I think fluoroscopy can be a really useful technique in these cases. And the other thing you might consider, particularly if you've been able to get an X-ray with the animal conscious, but it's not really clear whether there's anything abnormal, you could consider with care giving them some kind of contrast and then re-X-ray. And I've certainly, there is always a concern about regurgitating, but I've used diluted Omnipaque in the past, diluted in sterile saline on the assumption that if it did inhale some, it probably wouldn't cause too much difficulty. Certainly once or twice had some very pretty bronchograms where they have managed to inhale some of the material, but they do seem to clear that reasonably well.
Yeah.
So you could try that in certainly in practice, I think, with care. Small volume, allow it to swallow it and then re-X-ray and see whether it delineates the edges of the esophagus.
Yeah, and I think the key thing is to use diluted because it's very hypertonic. So if you use it undiluted, actually you've got quite a significant risk of causing lung injury. Of course, in the old days, they used to do barium bronchograms. They used to inhale barium. And I've seen some beautiful barium bronchograms, which were not done on purpose through dogs inhaling barium. And actually, as you said, I think they do recover okay. There are some reports in the literature of them doing very, very badly indeed, but my experience is it's okay. That is by no means a indication to go ahead and give it a go. You need to have a very careful risk assessment before you do these because, as I said, some of them can go very badly wrong indeed. So I think the dynamic test can be really useful if you're suspicious of dysfunction, and that's something that we can certainly offer in terms of the fluoroscopy. So moving on from that, say you've got an older dog, you've diagnosed it with what you consider to be mega esophagus. What are your next steps for that patient?
So I guess at this point, we're wanting to try to find out whether we have whether the mega esophagus is secondary to some kind of systemic disease or primary disease process that we might be able to treat, because then we've got a better chance perhaps of dealing with the mega esophagus itself, or whether it's idiopathic, so occurring for no known reason. So I would, my standard things at this point would be to start running those tests that medics love. Certainly basal cortisol, I think, although it's not necessarily a common finding with hypoadrenocorticism with Addison's, it can occur. I've seen one or two cases where it's been there and it has responded well to treatment. So the basal cortisol and then followed up with an ACTH stim if it's inappropriately low. Myasthenia gravis is another differential. One of the advantages of your plain X-ray, you may see a thymus or a thymic mass if there is one, and that can be associated. So there's an anti-ACH receptor antibody test. Amusingly, has to go to San Diego because apparently part of the test is derived from squid, because they've got so much muscle squid. Anyway, so it's, for some reason, that's where they developed it. So unfortunately, the turnaround for that is at least a couple of weeks at the moment. But you can submit that to look for evidence of myasthenia. I still tend to check thyroid function, although I think that's fairly controversial as to whether hypothyroidism genuinely causes significant neurologic dysfunction. There's various arguments about that, but usually it's a relatively straightforward thing to check, and at least rule it out fairly quickly, so maybe a T4 and TSH. And you might want to, I would run some general screening bloods as well, looking for any evidence of other disease. We're obviously looking at the animal in terms of any other clinical signs, any other abnormalities we might identify, because you can occasionally get very systemic autoimmune diseases and strange things like that. I guess if we were in the States, we'd think about granulomatous diseases and fungal diseases and oddities like that as well, but we at the moment at least thankfully don't seem to see those very often.
Yeah. I think the one I think that I would caution everyone to look really carefully for are the thymomas, because I know I've missed a little tiny thymoma once, and I think you need to get your two lateral radiographs with inflated lungs if you can, so that you do highlight them, because obviously that's a potentially treatable condition if you do identify it. Cool, okay, so you've identified it, you think it's idiopathic, how are you going to treat it, and what are you going to say to the owner?
I think this is perhaps one of the most important parts, because whatever you do testing-wise and however you're investigating, it'll take a little while to be sure about what you're dealing with, but the animal needs protection from aspiration straight away. And the big risk with these cases, even if it's idiopathic, there's no underlying disease, is aspiration and chronic infection, chronic pneumonia. And that tends to be what eventually will finish them off. It's very debilitating. So postural feeding is a key part of management. But what often can happen is that gets diluted down to saying feed from height, and the owner puts the food up on a box, and the animal's still standing with a horizontal esophagus accumulating material and then bringing it back up again. So the key is to get them vertical. So a Bailey chair, as illustrated, is a fantastic device, but you can fashion them potentially. There are various things online. You can make your own Bailey chair or get one ordered in. But you can also, depending on the size of dog, you may be able to, if they're tiny, you may be able to actually physically hold them up while they're eating. You could use a padded bucket. So anything you can do, but the main thing is to get the animal as vertical as possible, both while eating and for a good period afterwards, 20 to 30 minutes afterwards. And I think periodically through the day, if it's feasible, get the owner to do it as often as they can, because all the saliva the animal's swallowing and material coming up from the lung is constantly accumulating within that esophagus, and that's the frothy material they bring up. So keeping them vertical can encourage material to get down to the stomach. Sometimes if you play around a little bit with the texture of the food, so a lot of dogs seem to do well if you use a fairly sticky tinned food and roll it into balls, which they can swallow. Imagine them rolling down to the stomach. I'm not sure that's the case, but perhaps gives a little bit more distension to whatever function is left in the esophagus. Worth avoiding liquid foods, I think. You get the odd dog that seems to do better, but the liquid is more likely to be aspirated. And potentially, if there is any dysphagia, the dry food, again, it may be more likely to inhale little particles and problems of that sort. I would always avoid metoclopramide or sisopride. The temptation can be to think that they're vomiting, being sick, regurgitating, and perhaps if we empty the stomach, it'll help. But those drugs tend to increase the tone in the lower esophageal sphincter and actually can make things worse, just make it harder for material to get down to the stomach. So one thing that can be useful is sildenafil, so Viagra, a mg per kg, 3 times a day. That seems to reduce esophageal, lower esophageal tone, and may be beneficial in these cases. But the key is getting vertical.
I think one of the things that we always talked about in my last place of work, I was fortunate to work with one of the GI experts, Ed Hall, and he absolutely hated using PEG tubes in these dogs or any kind of gastrostomy feeding tube. I think partly because it doesn't necessarily reduce the regurgitation, it just provides a bypass, and actually he didn't consider it a long-term strategy or solution for these patients. What's your experience with them? Are you as averse, or will you consider them?
I never stand against what Ed said, of course, but I've never used a low profile tube. I must admit, the ones that have done well long term have seemed to do well because the management's been there and the owner's been willing to put the effort in, and I suppose that's the other thing we have to counsel the owners. This is a long-term condition. It may spontaneously resolve, but it may not, and the long-term outlook remains guarded, and there's a lot of effort involved. But I must say, I have never placed a low-profile PEG, but I understand that can be useful. I guess in a situation where the animal can't keep food down, like you say, if it's regurgitating that frequently, how well it'll do with a PEG, I'm not sure, but I can't claim to have any personal experience of that.
I think, well, no, I think my experience with them is not great when they have been used, and I think I very much agree with Ed now that actually we need to work on the owner and whether they're able to deal with it, because ultimately the owner's going to have to deal with the complications and the patient and the dog, and they've got to both enjoy their lives, so we don't want to increase stress too much. There's a lot of owner forums for these dogs, I think that's the other thing, and I found that owners that really engage with those forums seem to have a better quality of life because they learn and ask questions. And there are some people use collars around the neck to help the food stay down, and they seem to be successful for some patients. So I would look to the internet and look to the owner forums if you do have a patient, or at least direct your owner towards them, because I think there's some good stuff out there. So I'm going to move over. Someone's going to ask me some questions now, or I'm going to try and ask some questions.
Well, I might as well say something. I'm working up. Oh, okay. Hi, everyone. Nikki here. Sophie, what are the main causes of acute esophagitis in your practice?
So we're moving from chronic to acute, because that's mainly what I deal with. So I think in my practice, which is mainly on those patients that are hospitalised with acute illness, we see esophagitis in those dogs that have been vomiting a lot beforehand, or have some kind of GI disease, and they've suffered an esophagitis secondary to that. And they also seem to be the ones that are most difficult to manage. You'll also see acute esophagitis in dogs that have had reflux under GA, and that can occur within a couple of days normally of the anaesthetic. And then we'll sometimes see it secondary to retained esophageal foreign bodies, and more rarely now, because I think most people are aware, secondary to some medications, so particularly doxycycline, but also clindamycin. And I think everyone knows now that we should be following those medications with water boluses or food so that they aren't causing irritation of the esophagus. So I think those are the most common ones, and they vary in challenge. So I think the ones, as I said, that are most difficult to manage are those dogs that have had acute gastroenteritis, vomited a lot and developed an esophagitis or gastroesophageal reflux secondary to that. They'll often have some ileus as well, and it's difficult to work out what's the most important thing that's going on. Is it the ileus that's causing significant accumulation of fluid in the stomach, which is then causing gastroesophageal reflux, which is then causing an esophagitis, or is it an esophagitis secondary to the vomiting? And I think it can be a real mess to try and work out what came first, and ultimately you're left with trying to manage the side effects or what the consequences of it, and that they can be pretty tricky.
Oh, great, thank you. What steps can I take to avoid GI associated reflux? This is something that, well, it's not so much my problem, but I think those orthopaedic patients that always seem to be the ones that really we get this in, although it does happen to me as well, unfortunately.
So
how do I stop it?
So this is a really interesting question, because GI associated reflux has got loads of evidence in the veterinary literature, actually. So there's been loads of work done since about the 90s. There's a Greek group that started in Thessaloniki looking at this in the 90s, published a whole load of papers, and then there's been more and more prominence, particularly I think associated with us seeing more brachycephalics who are presenting, as we've already said, with regurgitation and upper respiratory signs, and then seem to develop reflux under anaesthesia. I think the first thing to say is those papers in the 90s identified that GA-associated reflux is pretty common. So a lot of patients will have this, but very few suffer a consequence of it. So what we need to do is think about which patients have an increased risk of it, but then increased risk of consequence associated with it. In most of the cases, you won't see any oral material. So actually that's relatively uncommon. And so what we, as I said, what we need to do is think about what we do in those cases where if we do have it, we might see more of a problem. So for me, those are those patients which may have presented with vomiting, so have an increased risk of esophagitis, maybe brachycephalic, and therefore may already have some esophageal dysfunction, and all those which might have an increased risk of aspiration pneumonia. So if they've got an unprotected airway, or if they've got a risk of aspiration post or in recovery, so if they've got decreased laryngeal function, which is actually quite a lot of our patients. It's one of the, I mean, it probably occurs under some sedation as well. So it's one of the reasons that I try to avoid too long prolonged sedation without protection of the airway as well. The risks that have been associated through the research are prolonged anaesthesia or recumbency, prolonged fasting beforehand. So if you starve a dog for too long, then you have an increased risk of reflux. Abdominal procedures and deep chested jokes. But I think what's really interesting that Mickey just said is that you see it in orthopaedic cases, and actually we do see it a lot in orthopaedic cases. And what's going on in those patients? I think it's the prolonged starvation, actually, because we think they're stable, and so we starve them from quite an early time the night before. They might have their last meal at 8, and then you're doing it the following, you know, midday afternoons. They've got this very prolonged starvation, and that's probably increasing their risk.
I think it's interesting because obviously you highlighted that brachycephalics are potentially greater risk of regurgitation than other breeds. But I think probably I noticed very, very little in the way of intraoperative regurgitation, contrary to the orthopaedic cases perhaps. So, but I think they're far more risk of sort of post-operative or regurgitation recovery, which is quite, I wonder if is that because we have their heads up most of the procedure, do you think?
they are in a different position. They're prone as opposed to on their side, aren't they? So yeah, possibly. They're head down, aren't they, with their stomach up if they're doing an orthopaedic op potentially.
One of the reasons why we don't like to combine brachycephalic surgery with other procedures.
So that's kind of the risk factors. The question is what can we do to avoid it? So I think there's no point trying to avoid it in every case because we're just not going to be able to because it's so common, unfortunately. But what we do is try to mitigate any risk associated with it if it does happen. So in those higher risk cases, we'll use a proton pump inhibitor for maybe a day or 2 days before the procedure if we can. And then there is some relatively good evidence that metoclopramide used at a relatively high dose, so 1 to 2 mg/kg, and then used as a CRI during the procedure can reduce the risk associated with it. But the evidence even of that is pretty mixed. So there's a couple of papers that say it's beneficial, at least one paper that says that it isn't. It's definitely not routine in most patients, but we do consider those steps routine in our brachycephalics. As I said, they seem to be at risk of increased regurgitation, and what we don't want is them aspirating into lungs that have probably been aspirated into before, so setting up inflammation on inflammation. If we do see it, then I think it's sensible to flush out the esophagus with saline. Some people use bicarbonate as well. The evidence for that is pretty weak in that there's some sort of single center studies looking at it. Ultimately, dilution is the solution to pollution. So if you use enough saline or water, then you're going to dilute any acid that is there. And then we would probably treat with some PPIs in the post-recovery period for 3 days or so.
Proton pump inhibitor, yeah?
Yeah, one of them. One of them.
Line of duty, isn't it?
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah.
With a very brief detail into what we consider to be a reasonable fasting now, because I think it's an interesting thing. We've changed that a lot, haven't we? But
yeah,
it's a big topic, possibly.
It is a big topic, and I tend to starve for 6 to 8 hours, but actually, you know, there is a paper which shows very short fasting or no fasting is fine. Ultimately, it needs to be a decision that you're comfortable with, because the evidence isn't secure enough to say this is definitely what we should do. If you don't fast dogs, you'll definitely see more vomiting.
Yes.
So you have to balance that up.
I was just thinking,
because
Yeah.
So I think we are tending now to, you know, if we know a procedure isn't going to go until late afternoon, we'll often give them an early warning overnight if they're staying up like maybe 5-6 a.m. small breakfast just to try and reduce the risk. It seems. I know it's associated with quicker recovery in people as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Less problems fasting. Sorry, a bit of detail.
No, I think it's really sensible because actually, you know, that's a really practical piece of advice. It's just that nothing's quite clear cut enough to say yes, definitively this. But I think if we're thinking of a morning procedure, we'd probably take the food out between 12 and 2 in the morning. So, you know, that's probably 6 to 8 hours starving.
Okay, thank you. What treatments do you use for esophagitis in addition to them?
Ooh. So there's no treatment specifically for esophagitis. What we can do is try and prevent worsening of clinical signs. So if we think or assume that in these dogs there's some dysfunction of the esophagus and the lower esophageal sphincter, if we have continued acid on the area, then it's going to make the situation worse. So we try to alter the pH of the stomach using proton pump inhibitors to try and minimise any ongoing acid reflux and damage to the esophagus. So that's the primary treatment, actually. And we would use omeprazole twice a day, 1 mg/kg. You can use the other prazoles, potentially. Ranitidine is probably not worth giving because it does nothing to the acidity within the stomach, but famotidine can have some benefits if you can get hold of it. So those are the two agents. Omeprazole is beneficial or useful because it can be given as an IV drug, whereas famotidine is oral only.
I believe so, but I think the key is twice daily.
Yeah, so twice daily I think is the important thing. Previously we've only given it once a day, but actually we know now that twice a day is probably what you need. Esophagitis is definitely painful, and there's people try different treatments to try and reduce the amount of pain associated with it. You can use aluminium hydroxide or those types of binding solutions. Sucralfate was popular. Its variable availability has led to people using it less and less, and actually in people it's not used, human patients it's not used very much. You can get sucralfatoliths if you use a lot of it, so you don't really want to cause an obstruction secondary to it. There are lots of different combinations of aluminium hydroxide with lignocaine as well. So I think for the most painful patients, we can actually try to give some local analgesia as well. The other thing is, if these patients aren't getting any oral intake, then we might need to consider a feeding tube. And most people would recommend using a gastric feeding tube in these cases, so PEG or surgically paced gastrotomy tube. I have used NG tubes and esophageal tubes, but if the patient has ongoing regurgitation, I would just take them out, or if they seem to be very irritating to the patient. As I said, the most challenging of these cases seem to be the ones that have the esophagus to secondary to their acute abdominal disease. And in those patients, we might have ileus as well. So we may be using metoclopramide to try and cause some movement within the gastrointestinal tract, but nutrition will help there as well. I think the important thing to remember is that these dogs generally will not tolerate a full diet or a full RER. So you need to trickle it in, normally by constant rate infusion. So use the liquid diets that are available through Royal Canin. They're really good. They're just horribly expensive, but they go through a syringe driver. They go through very small tubes, so they're really useful for these kinds of patients. So those are my primary treatments for esophagitis. I think the other thing is, they can look really grim and actually not be that bad in terms of clinical signs. So it's the clinical signs that should predominate. So don't worry too much about what it looks like if the dog's not showing any clinical signs. And this is particularly important when you have things like esophageal foreign bodies. Most of the dogs that I've removed those from have gone home the next day eating normally, despite the most ragged looking esophagus.
It's always magnified as well, isn't it? So
yes, it is.
Perhaps it truly is, although
And then I think most dogs do recover. You just need to take a lot of time and a bit of patience. The worst extreme, if you have very severe esophagitis, is to get an esophageal stricture. And for those people that have or are looking at the images, we've got a picture of one of those up now. And these can be really, this is magnified, remember. So it's quite a small hole, and these dogs will present with classic regurgitation. And they normally occur about 2 weeks after the initiating signs of the esophagitis. In these cases, we will use balloon dilation, which allows smoother dilation under more control than with a Boujnage technique. But most dogs will require repeat dilation. I don't know if that's your experience as well. No. You normally need to give them 3 or 4 good goes, and there is a risk of rupture associated with them. But there's a picture of a dog having a balloon dilation. These pictures are not fantastic. They are 15 years old now, so we didn't have such good technology back then. So we've already mentioned brachies, and we're going to move over to Mickey now.
Okay.
And Adam can pipe him in if he wants. So we see a lot of brachycephalics with regurgitation as well as their upper airway disease. How do you approach them? What do you do about the regurgitation?
Well, it's an excellent question. I suppose there's a lot of things to think about here. So, depends, are we just talking about brachycephalics full stop or brachycephalics with significant upper airway?
Let's start with the ones with significant airway disease first.
So, you know, generally, a lot of these animals, their gastroesophageal signs will be exacerbated or potentially even caused by their airway obstruction. So, the idea is that they have lots of very significant. Increased intrathoracic pressure, so they've got a lot of negative pressure because they're constantly trying to suck in the air, and that has a knock-on effect on the esophagus and potentially the stomach, so leading to relatively high levels of esophagitis and gastritis and regurgitation. So a lot of the time with these animals, if we fix their airway, so if we perform brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome surgery, so shortening their soft palates, widening their nostrils, plus or minus other bits and bobs, then not only does their airway improve and their respiratory signs improve, but also a lot of the time their gastroesophageal signs will significantly improve or resolve. Having said that, we recognise that a lot of these dogs are regurgitating prior to surgery, so you know, clearly, as we've identified, that increases the risk of complications. And so, for me, with animals with significant regurgitation prior to surgery, we'll always try and treat them sort of prophylactically or preemptively with omeprazole or a proton pump inhibitor. And some people will suggest doing that for 2 to 3 weeks prior to airway surgery. I think it's a lot potentially more complicated because we, particularly in French bulldogs, we recognise that a lot of the individuals with airway disease and regurgitation have significant sort of almost structural abnormalities. So when you do a bear and swallow on a French bulldog that's regurgitating a lot, it's pretty common for them to have poor esophageal motility, so reduced function, potentially a slightly redundant or saggy esophagus. It's not a mega esophagus, but it's certainly not performing as you'd one would wish their esophagus to perform. They have quite a high rate of gastroesophageal reflux, and also quite a large, reasonable proportion of them have hiatal hernia. They've certainly seen a number of dogs where they've had significant hiatal hernia prior to airway surgery, and then their gastroesophageal signs have essentially resolved after their airway has been treated. Interestingly, I think some of those animals continue to have a sliding hiatal hernia, but it doesn't seem to, as far as we can tell, it doesn't seem to be clinically significant. So it's quite uncommon to have to do hiatal hernia surgery, although we do it in a small number of dogs, typically French bulldogs or possibly bulldogs, English bulldogs. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Primarily, we're looking at fixing their airway and then reassessing. You don't go in straight away and fix the hiatal hernia that you've identified.
Very, very unlikely. I mean, you will obviously occasionally pick up a dog where its airway seems to be, well, inverted commas, normal for the breed. So, or a better example, so animals where they're essentially regurgitating all over the show, but actually seemingly have good exercise tolerance, and the owners, even on careful examination, because obviously you can't trust them because they have a lot of cognitive bias about this, but actually the owners don't report significant airway issues. And those animals may well have primary gastroesophageal disease, but it becomes quite difficult because then should you be trying to improve, they're probably, airway isn't normal being a brachycephalic, so should we be trying to do an intervention on their airway before managing their gastroesophageal disease? I don't think we really know. Probably not. If they can run around outside without collapsing, then they probably don't. It's hard to imagine that the airway is the main cause, but it may well be playing a role.
Tricky cases then, so careful evaluation.
Most of them are a bad airway, bad regurgitation, so that helps decision making.
All right, and then I think we're going to kind of round up now with a little bit on esophageal foreign bodies. So I don't think they're really commonly encountered, but I think they're often a bit of a challenge, and we are lucky here in that we have all the equipment that we could need to manage an esophageal foreign body. But I thought it was worth mentioning because people do see them in practice. So what are your top tips for managing esophageal foreign bodies? So let's say a bone.
So overwhelmingly, my main tip for managing esophageal foreign bodies is to make sure you have a massive pair of grasping forceps. If you haven't got the appropriate grasping forceps, then you don't even start, because you will not, using forceps passed down an endoscope, you will not remove a bone from foreign body. But you will spend a lot of time feeling very sad trying.
Nibbling bits of rotting flesh.
And sometimes it looks like you've got it, and actually you're only seeing the tip of it. Absolutely. And you won't get it. So yeah. Without wishing to plug anything, veterinary instrumentation sell a number of forceps. And if you in your practice, if you will see esophageal foreign bodies regularly and want to remove them yourself, then you need to go and buy a set of big daddy forceps or big mummy forceps, depending on.
Absolutely.
My top tip.
And I think apart from that, you can use fluoroscopic guidance, which I know that you prefer, or you can use endoscopic guidance. I think the benefit of using fluoroscopic guidance, if you've got it, is you can't grab the end of the endoscope by mistake and cause significant damage to it. You can also give barium before you do the procedure, whereas you don't really want to get barium down your scope channel at all. So I'd like the scope because I can see what I'm looking at, and you can kind of your way around the outside, but
I found with scopes you can, one thing sometimes helps is to get a catheter down through the scope if you've got one, or if it's a decent sized scope, and get it beyond the foreign bodies. Often the way around it, they're often quite irregular, aren't they? There'll be little gaps, and get some lube down there, get a little bit of mix a bit of sail on, a bit of lube, and just try and almost, you know, quite floated out, but these things often have been in there for a little while. They're starting to dry up a little bit. They're quite unpleasant to try and get hold of. I think if you haven't got the grasping forceps, with a bit of manoeuvring, you can sometimes get a snare or even a basket around enough of the foreign body to start to shift it. But Nicky's absolutely right. You really need something that will get hold of it and not let go and give you enough purchase to start to move it up very gradually.
What about pushing or pulling? Sorry.
Well, the other thing would be, the other key fact, I think, is that unless the owners are literally like, do this or it's euthanasia, then you've got to be prepared to open the dog's chest if it goes wrong. So if you're going to pull it, and unfortunately, occasionally, they have esophageal perforation. So, I think it's no problem with, doing it, but I think it's worth having a conversation with the client before you do it, saying, what will we do if there is a tear? And if the answer is I want the thoracotomy and you're not happy to do it, then probably not sensible to proceed with the minimally invasive removal. Pushing or pulling, whatever you can do. So I normally try and pull them out because it feels nice to actually have produce the fending article. But some of these dogs, the foreign body will not come out, in which case actually they will be more readily pushed into the stomach, and that's just fine.
Yeah, I think I like to pull them as well, but sometimes they just push a lot easier, and they're actually normally most of the way down already, so actually they're almost just in front. Yeah. You just need to make sure that it's something that can be digested. So bone, fine. Hot potato, fine. Hot chicken breast, which I've removed as well, fine, but you probably want to remove the toy that's got stuck down there.
That's a good point with the bone especially, is there's no need to do a gastrectomy and take it out.
No,
it should dissolve nicely in the gastric acid.
And they go remarkably quickly. So I think that's the other thing. But remember that loads of people feed bones, more meaty bones, to their patients, so to their pets. So they do go. I've just put this radiograph up because this is what happens when things go wrong. So the first, if you've got the screen, we had an image of a lateral radiograph with a load of bits just sitting mid-esophagus, which the larger bits were cranial, for those of you that are old enough to remember them, they're barium impregnated polythene spheres sitting just cranial to the foreign body. We went in, tried to remove it, and the foreign body ruptured, or the esophagus ruptured, so we removed. And this subsequent radiograph shows a pneumothorax and also bits throughout the thorax, really, which is never really what you want to see. So this dog had a thoracotomy to repair. I think the other thing is surgical removal is an option.
Yep.
But it's probably not going to be cheaper than trying to remove via endoscopy.
I think it's uncommon not to try endoscopic or fluoroscopic removal prior to surgery. But surgery is always an option, so a thoracotomy and then esophagotomy. Might be so some fish hooks look pretty alarming if they're very, very barbed, so that might be an indication for thoracotomy. Of course, occasionally you might have a foreign body lodged in the neck, although I'm not sure I've ever truly seen it. So that would make a surgical approach potentially more readily achievable.
I've seen cats with foreign bodies in the neck, so I had a wishbone sticking the wrong way up in the cats. That was pretty tricky because you had to break it to get it out because it was pointing in the wrong direction. You mentioned fish hooks because I think we do see fish hooks.
What well, I had to go on Sunday.
Yeah, what do you do? Hooks, like what do you do with these? Same approach?
Yeah, so again, you can do this endoscopically or fluoroscopically. I mean, I do most of them endoscopically now because it's just how it's gone. But so in an ideal world, if you've got the line still attached, that really helps. So the two key things for fish hooks is one is you need to disengage, if the fish hook is trapped, you need to disengage it from the wall of the esophagus, and then you need to remove it from the esophagus without catching it again, which is sort of a bit of a kerfuffle sometimes. So if you've got the line still attached, then that's really helpful because it gives you another point of manipulation. But if you pass the scope down, you should be able to see the fish hook. Can try and figure out the orientation of it, and then potentially what you can do is slide a tube, like an ET tube or stomach tube, down the line, and then that can be used to minute. If you put the tension on the line, you can then use the tube to actually sort of put counter pressure on the hook and hopefully disengage it from the wall. Because most of the time, they're sort of the hook is pointing rostrally, isn't it? So it always seems. So you want to sort of push it away from yourself, get out of the wall, and then actually, if you pull up on the line more, you can then hopefully. Sometimes you can get the hook to embed in the tube, and then that means you can pull it out without it catching. If you haven't got the string, it becomes slightly more problematic. Again, we can try and manipulate the hook with the forceps passed through the scope. And obviously, fish is much smaller than most bone form bodies, so that becomes more plausible. The other thing that I often like to do is use a smaller pair of grasping, well, when I say smaller, so long grasping forceps, but smaller than the massive ones that you can get for esophageal bone form bodies. And you can use them passed alongside the endoscope to manipulate the hook. And you can actually slide the, on Sunday we slid the tube down, pretended that the forceps are actually the line, and then use the tube down the forceps to help disengage it. And that worked really nicely.
Yeah, I think, hours of battling sometimes. I think that's the other thing. A bit of patience can be helpful with these animals. But the hook's always pointing towards you. So you always have to, it's what's difficult, I think, is pushing it away. And if the old tube over the tube doesn't work, then you have to kind of use the scope almost to kind of force everything, push it all away. Any tips, Adam?
I've rode a few where particularly if they're very curved and the barb is usually trying to stop you from pushing back the way it's come, is to if you can get hold of the tip, is to pull it all the way through. If it's not too large and there's too much line attached to it. But sometimes you can actually encourage them to carry on the way they were trying to go, and you have to
thread them through.
Yeah, you have to sort of thread it, you have to keep moving slightly.
There's some quite exciting blood vessels in adjacent to this area, so there is the potential for bad things to happen.
Well, I think most of them have actually caught the mucosal layer. Yeah, I don't worry. I'm not very paranoid about these.
They've gone through. They've come back out again. You've almost got. You can see both ends almost, and the tips come back out. I guess it could have gone through a vessel, but at that point, you might be able to encode it. These are usually very small hooks.
Cool. So I think we've covered everything. So I was just going to run over some very quick take-home points. I think the first thing is ensure that we've determined the cause of the problem. Make sure it's regurgitation or vomiting so that you know what you're investigating. Be ready to reevaluate. I think that's what I've learned in my years. Sometimes you just have to kind of go back to the owner and say, can I just clarify, make sure that what we're looking at is the right thing. Use imaging wisely. These dogs, if they are regurgitating, are at risk of complications associated with sedation and anesthesia. They might develop aspiration pneumonia. They might already have it. And then consider the skill set and equipment you have available to you. So if you don't have those massive grasping forceps and there's an esophageal foreign body, it's worth speaking to a local practice, find out if they have any or a referral center who normally do, or consider if you're seeing a few of them getting some and looking at the techniques, training yourselves up, doing a bit of practice, manipulating them. It's not something you learn that easily, because putting a scope and a large pair of forceps down in the esophagus, they don't move well against each other. Mm-hmm. So it can be trickier to do than you think it's going to be. Microesophagus needs patient owners and a lot of support, and I think support from their peers, the people out there who have dogs with the same problem, can be really useful for them, as well as support from you and appropriate counselling. There's no point telling them it's all going to be okay, because it probably isn't. Be patient with those dogs with acute esophagitis. It can take a lot of time and care to get these patients better, and you need to approach from multiple angles and be a little bit gentle, but also think about what you're doing. So I particularly hate polypharmacy, but in these patients, actually only one or two drugs that are going to have the benefit. So let's stick to those and think about everything else that we're doing. Think about the other drugs that you're giving and how they may well be contributing to the problems that you've already got. Always think about the upper airway and brachycephalics if they're presenting with regurgitation. It seems almost counterintuitive, but I think we know now that that's probably the cause in the majority of them. So get that sorted and the regurgitation will fix to some degree, although it might not become completely normal. And finally, if you do see esophageal foreign bodies, I've mentioned those already, they've got a relatively good prognosis, particularly with early diagnosis. If they've been sitting there 10 days, then the esophagus is normally not in a very happy place by that time. And you've probably got an increased risk of rupture. I think with us, there's always this decision, do we just cut it or do we rupture it first and then go in and manage the complication? Actually, even if they do rupture, if the owner's got the money, then the prognosis is pretty good, but they do need acute management and awareness of what's going on so that you've identified it. I think there was a paper that described medical management for esophageal rupture, but I've never been brave enough to do that. I would always go in and manage it surgically. Anything you two want to add? No?
Thank
you very much for listening, and check us out next month with our ureteral disease.